Major Mills, Rail 9. So we got to the point where in June 1945 you went to the Staff College at Sandhurst. Could you tell us a bit about, it was a 16-week course.
A 16-week course, and this was mainly for static formations. There were two wings to the Staff College. There was Staff College Camberley and Staff College Sandhurst. Now, Staff College Sandhurst was mainly people like myself who were forced through injury, one thing or another, into an administrative situation, and we were concerned more with static formations than with mobile formations. Anyway, the course was an extremely good course. It lasted 16 weeks. We were a very hard-working crowd of people, worked extremely hard. We worked in the evenings. We held meetings in our rooms to discuss problems. We worked in syndicates, sub-syndicates. We got various...
Can you tell us a bit about how that worked? Because people are quite interested in the way the syndicates, you know, developed and the British Army theory of it.
During the course, you got one move, if I remember rightly. You started with one DS. The DSs were all lieutenant colonels. I was under Lieutenant Colonel Lord Winford, W-Y-N-F-O-R-D, whose name before he inherited the title was Bobby Best, apparently. Excellent man, very clean-cut features, very good-living bloke.
He was your personal tutor, was he?
He taught a syndicate of 12 of us.
How did the syndicates work?
Well, you did a lot of work in syndicates, studying various aspects, various schemes, and you did a lot of work went to a lot of lectures where the whole of the college would be assembled. Now, every exercise you did, you studied, at the end of it all, you got what they called a blue. And a blue was the school solution to the problem, as it were. And sometimes they would admit that some of our work that we produced was better than the blue, which is very satisfactory.
Now, which course were you? They have numbers, don't they?
I think it was 32, 34, I can't remember.
What sort of exercises were you doing? Now, if you could talk about that in some detail.
Quite a number of tutes. We did quite a number of tutes.
What was a typical tute like?
Well, I'll give you an example of one tute that was most interesting. Because, don't forget, a lot of us had been in battle. And that time, I was in a syndicate commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Sturrock, S-T-U-R-R-O-C-K, Royal Engineers, and we were doing a platoon or company attack, correction, company defense of farm buildings. In imagination, we were stood right there in front of these buildings, very hefty, thick-walled stone farm buildings. We were out there. And I was in charge of the troops inside these buildings, and the member of the syndicate, who was Royal Artillery, said, "Oh, I'll soon get you out. I'll just put a regiment onto you." And I said, "You will not. You will not get me out at all from that." I said, "We shall stay there while all your HE bursts off these walls, and you won't get us out in that way. Yeah, I'll put two regiments on you." No, I said, "I'm sorry." And this went on. And the DS said, "Well, look, gentlemen, we can't go on like this all the time. There's got to be an answer." And then the divisional commander came along, a Colonel Hinde, H-I-N-D-E, of the, I think it was Essex Regiment. And he had just come back from Italy. And they turned to him and put him a problem. And he said, "Mills is right. He would not shift. But Mills, I will shift you, because I shall bring up an anti-tank gun, and I'll start putting solid shot through the walls. It'll go through the walls and spin around the room, take your blokes' heads off. I said, yes, we would then go. It was quite interesting.
And that was a typical sort of thing?
Typical tute, yeah.
That's, and what other ways of teaching? There's a tute, tactical exercise without tute. Right?
And exercise it on paper, given a definite puzzle.
What sort of thing?
Well, for instance, one was to work out the route to take an armoured division from Calais down to a point near Cherbourg. That was the direction, and you had to work out the most suitable roads and avoid soft ground, etc., etc. It was quite interesting. We had others concerning the movement of railway trains. One or two on quartering. You got the questions, and you worked out the answers.
You said it was more administrative for static units, but there seems to be a fair amount of tactical.
A fair amount. It did not let you forget your tactical stuff. No. Quite a bit of that.
Was there a competitive atmosphere in the course, either between individuals or between syndicates?
No. The competition was between you and your success rate. You wanted to get through this course successfully, and I think everybody there was conscientious. Out of 50 people, there are only two men who were not graded at the end. When you're not graded, they simply put in ACIs or whatever the publication is. So and so attended the course. I was fortunate. I did work very hard, and I was very gratified on the last day of the course with six other people. We marshalled up in front of the commandant of the college, who congratulated all seven of us on our outstanding performance. So I posted to...
Hang on, just a moment. Did they study many historical battles? I mean, or was it just Second World War by then? Because they had studied a lot of First World War actions in the past. Had they sort of switched entirely to the Second World War?
It was entirely the Second World War and looking forward, and inclined to look forward, looking forward to the situation that could exist if the Far East War was going on. And the Far East War finished while I was there. But up to the time that this happened, I had been told by one of the instructors that I was being earmarked to be sent to the fleet in the Navy, according to the Navy, in the Far East, because they were working a scheme of supporting troops landing and including airborne landings with naval artillery, and they wanted officers to liaise with the Navy. And this was being talked about to me, and this was going to be my posting. But of course, the moment that the war in the Far East finished, that posting stopped.
Did you actually manoeuvre real troops at all, or was it entirely toots?
Entirely toots, and no real troops at all.
Sand tables?
No, we didn't have sand tables, but we used to lay out installations with cardboard models on the floor of lecture rooms. Yeah.
Now, what was your next posting?
I went.
That was about October, would it be?
October. I went as G2 to Norfolk Sub-District, and I didn't know what it was all about. But when I got there, I realised that the main task there was the responsibility for taking all the mines in the along the coast.
Now, where were you based with this?
Norwich, based just outside Norwich, a place called Catton Hall, C-A-T-T-O-N Hall.
And you were saying that the main responsibility was...
We had engineers, to we had liaise with engineers who were doing the mine lifting. Each field was properly labelled, marked on the map. A lot of changes had taken place on the beach because of the shifting sands. There's a lot of inaccurate information on the cliffs, because there were mines in the cliffs, there were fields behind the cliffs also full of mines, and they had to be gone over very carefully, over and over again, and in the end, the G2 had to go there with the engineers, be satisfied that there were no mines left in that area.
How would you be satisfied about that?
Well, it's very difficult.
Do you see what I mean? Because
you'd have the original record, which would be only... It was a difficult job to align the original record with the piece of ground you were on. You asked how many sweeps had been made over it. They had the best mine sweeping equipment they possibly could have, including a device called the ERA, and I can't remember how it worked, but it was extremely extremely effective. And it was really with consultation of the Royal Engineers that you got convinced that it was that you would recommend the commander to sign a clearance certificate.
Did you find that an onerous responsibility? Because, of course, if you'd been wrong ever, then...
It was certainly an onerous responsibility. One had to take one's time, and you had to have a very... I thought you had to have a very good rapport with the engineers. And I found the Royal Engineers an extremely great bunch to work with. I thoroughly enjoyed my time working with them.
Did you actually go out and did you see how they went about it?
Oh, yes, I've stood and watched.
Well, how did they do it?
On the beach they had 8 hoses collecting water with 8 pumps driven into one jet, and they would just wash the beach away until they could see a mine. And then they would stop the water, walk up to the mine, and very, very carefully lift it out and stack it. And then, periodically, they would blow them.
Where would they blow them? In situ or...?
No, they'd cart them away from many buildings. But on the beach, they'd blow them, yeah.
And did they suffer casualties?
Yes, there had been casualties. I was never present when a casualty took place. But they certainly had casualties.
And I know this is... Were any beaches that were meant to have been cleared, were there any casualties ever where a certificate had been issued?
No, it was always in the course of actually digging them up.
So, the beaches you'd recommended were clear?
Well, yes, but my own personal thoughts were that as the numbers never stacked up accurately with the records, and the beaches had shifted to such an extent, there must be a chance of a mine or two being left somewhere. I never really felt all that happy about the beaches. Now, on the cliffs and behind the cliffs, it was easier. You could be more certain, but there were areas where the dunes were so crumbly that the RE said, look, just don't attempt it. Put a wire around and declare it to be no man's land forever and for always. As far as I know, those areas are still banned to people. I mean, an enormous number of mines were laid, thousands of mines. And it's the old story. Anybody can lay them down and make sloppy records. Taking them up is one hell of a game.
Now that was one side of your work, and that was the biggest part of your work.
Yes,
but what could you perhaps comment on what the job of G2 staff officer was?
Well, it was the other one was the surveillance of the prisoner of war camps.
Tell me about that.
We had to tour the prisoner of war camps and talk with the commandant and staff there, make certain it's being run properly.
So basically you were just inspecting them to make sure everything was all right.
Yes, that's right.
What sort of things were you looking for?
Really, the prisons themselves were securely held, being well treated, being well fed, being medically taken care of. That was what you were looking for.
And was that largely the case?
Yes, I never had any problem at all with any camp. No problem at all. One or two of the German prisoners were slightly mental through battle fatigue. One or two of them were in extremely poor health through service on the Russian front. And I found their officers completely, the officers, their own officer in charge of the men, their Germans, plus the doctor who would be a German, were perfectly competent people. The only thing that ever surprised me was that the dentists were graded corporal.
And what other roles did you have?
Liaison with battalions stationed there, various infantry battalions.
Now, what did that entail? What sort of liaison role?
They wanted help with securing permission to carry out exercises in various areas. We were asked to consult them over the content of various ACIs that were coming out.
ACIs?
Army Counter Instructions that were being in draft form to get their reaction of officers and men to that. We had a responsibility also for vetting ranges. Old comrades rifle associations were springing up like mushrooms, and the ACIs gave a specification of what was a safe range, the kind of backing behind the target area and all that sort of stuff. And we had to inspect these and at the same time certify that they could be used.
Because a rifle range needs, if it's, was it 303 rifles?
303, yeah.
It needs quite a...
It's a hell of a banking behind it. Well, it's enormous banking.
But they also have to be a big space behind
it. Yes, a big space behind it too, yes. All that had to be gone into. And people were, I say, they're springing up like men, sending in their applications for certification. And we had to be very hard about that because they were anxious to get going, and we had to criticize them. In fact, I don't think I can remember more than one or two approvals the whole time I was there.
And these were private rifle ranges, essentially, commercial or...
No, they were... They were associations of, how should I put it, like... The meeting we had the other night yourself, the PRA, there'd be the Association of Norfolk Regiment Veterans, you know, in King's Lynn. We'd want a rifle range, that sort of thing. That was mainly that.
But most of them were rejected from...
Rejected until they got things right. At first go, I never remember an approval at first go. Never. And that reminds me of another area, too. We used to... help a lot to regenerate activity with the Army Cadet Force.
Now, how did you go about regenerating that?
Well, we used to attend their parades. We used to give lectures to the cadets. We would give any help with if they wanted any equipment. We'd try and find it for them. If we couldn't scrounge it, we'd apply for it. Two ways we used to be in touch with the schools that still had a cadet force attached to them, and also the Army Cadet Force, you know, itself was based on various drill halls was coming up. It was all emerging out of the woodwork.
What sort of relationship did you have with the Norfolk Regiment? Because we've done a lot of work with
yes,
the Norfolk Regiment.
We had extremely good relationship. When I was there, the Norfolk Depot was in Norwich. It was headed by a very nice man, a Lieutenant Colonel Hewick, H-E-W-I-C-K. Very nice chap, very nice wife. And we used to visit a lot, and I can't remember what we did, but...
Was this up to the Britannia Barracks?
Britannia Barracks, that's right. Yeah, I forgot the name. Yeah. Used to go down there a lot. And, of course, at that time... There was a Norfolk VC, I presume he was a major by then, Jameson, J-A-M-E-S-O-N, was a VC. I'd been in hospital with him when I was in Bosses. But there you are, he went out and got himself a VC, and he was taking part in leading various parades and things. Yeah, we saw a lot of the Norfolk Regiment.
Could you comment a little about the normal role of a G2?
Normal role of a G2 is to do everything concerned with operations. You're not concerned with administration. That's the DAQMG and the DAQMG at sub-district level.
And so that's why you had a variety, but that obviously in peacetime wasn't...
Well, this is another thing, you see. I realised that I was now becoming part of a peacetime army, and this tipped the scales in my mind to decide not to stay on in the army.
Hang on, just before you go on, could you perhaps run through the roles of... you'll have covered it at Staff College, I know you didn't do... Yeah. ..of the various members of the staff.
You've got the commander... overall command responsibility. You had the DAQMG, I'm talking about a sub-district headquarters. At a higher headquarters, that's divided, of course, but the DAQMG, Deputy Assistant Quartermaster General, he would take care of all administrative problems. You have the GSO2, who is responsible for all matters concerning operations, training, etc. And then you've got each of those two appointments has under him a staff officer grade 3, a captain.
And what exactly was a sub-district? As you said, you hadn't known what it was. How did that fit into the command?
Well, you've got three sub-districts. You had Norfolk sub-district, Suffolk, and it must have been Essex, I think the three of them. And the district headquarters was in Newmarket. And then several districts put them together, and you've got a command.
So that was Eastern District, was it? Or
East Anglia District, I think.
And the command overall would be?
Eastern Command. I can't remember where Eastern Command was. I have a feeling it was at Colchester.
Now, what exactly, you wanted to be a regular, what exactly, could you talk a bit more about this sort of peacetime business and how you decided?
Well, I could see in front of me a rather duller existence than I had had up to the time of leaving Staff College. And I thought, medical category B, it's going to hamper me all the time. I'm always going to be different from everybody else around me. And I thought, well, no. I went and saw British American Tobacco, my firm. They wanted to get me abroad. I was specially trained for China. I taught Chinese before the war. But they said, no, you can forget China. That's overrun by communists. We're going to get thrown out. But we'd like you to consider going out to the Middle East. We're going to get you to start learning Arabic.
So you discussed this with BAT before you actually left the army.
Yeah, I went down there and worked it out very carefully, and I thought that the best thing I could do, although army camaraderie and all that sort of thing was going to be missed, the sort of loyalty you get in army compared with the backbiting you get in business, all that sort of thing, that wasn't going to be very pleasant, but I decided that for the future, for the long-distance future, the best thing I could do was to get back into BAT and put my heart into that, which I did.
Now, tell me about the demobilisation process.
Oh, it was very simple. I worked on until they gave me a demob date, And I said cheerio to everybody.
When was that? When
did you... it would be well into June.
46.
Yes, and took myself down to a demob centre, which must have been Guildford or somewhere like there. I think it was either Guildford or Woking, I can't remember. And you arrived, and you went from one place to another, and you gradually acquired a suit and a pair of shoes and a hat and a suitcase.
And what did you think of the suit? And, well, the clothing generally you were given.
I didn't grumble. I certainly did not grumble because, you know, clothing was short in those days. I was just glad to have another suit. The chaps that helped you into your suit and tried you on, and they seemed to be very civil people. There was no question of rank at all. You just lined up alongside everybody else. And I went away still wearing my uniform, but carrying the other stuff. Yep. Then eventually, when I got home, I got a savings book with my gratuity in it. And a letter saying that if I wanted to, I could use my rank in civil life, which I didn't.
What made you decide not to do that? Because some people did, some people do, some people don't. You know,
what?
Use your rank in civil life.
I feel that it's pompous, especially if your rank is not a very high rank. I reverted to Mr. right away.
Now, what about your career with BAT? Could you just sketch that out for us to give an idea of what happened to you after the war?
They seconded me eventually to the Foreign Office Administration of African Territories to put me on the staff of the old Italian tobacco monopoly in Tripolitania. The rules of conquest are that the conquering power must keep maintaining the law of the country which is conquered. So the state monopoly had to carry on, but it was the Foreign Office decided to invite employees of British American Tobacco Company to come in and do it. So having spent 6 months in head office, nothing like 6 months, good God, no. A matter of 3 months in head office to revise my administrative training I had before the war. I then went out to Tripoli to finish my factory training out there in the factory there and to get stuck into the business as a whole. And I arrived in Tripoli in November 1946. I was immediately told you either learn the languages or get fired. Great rule. So I stuck into the two languages there, Italian and Arabic, and worked very hard at them, as well as learning the job in the factory. Then I got sent in May the next year. Would it be a little later than May? I think it was May. May I got appointed manager of the state monopoly in next door in Cyrenaica, based on Benghazi. And I found more and more the question of diplomacy was coming into the job of running a tobacco business. Now, funny enough, although these were monopolies, they had intense competition from smugglers. If you have a monopoly, and you will always get smuggling, people bringing in cigarettes from elsewhere. That was your competition, and really it was quite hard graft. And then, as the independent British retired from the point of being the occupying power, and the independent Libyan government started taking shape, so one's ability to run a state monopoly without interference became quite hazardous, and I had to spend a lot of my time arguing with Arab ministers and people like that, and I found the diplomatic side started coming in